Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this Labor Day Monday across the United States. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and at least according to some in the Vatican, an important Catholic influencer. You are an important Catholic influencer. And I just think it's wonderful that the Vatican is reaching out to other people to help communicate. I think that's just a great strategy. Yeah,
I agree.
You were already telling us earlier that, wait, don't tell me, Spring-Heeled Jack makes an appearance, is the topic of this week's Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which will drop on Friday. A Victorian devil, demon, superhero? We're not sure.
Mm-hmm. But we'll find out. Hellboy.
Hellboy. I'm not really familiar with Hellboy. Is he a bad guy or a good guy? Like, I mean,
Well, yeah, my understanding, I've never really read Hellboy, but Hellboy is not published. He's published by one of the lesser known comic book companies. And my understanding is he is a demon who is gone good and serving as a superhero, kind of like Etrigan at DC Comics. It was created by the legendary comic book creator Jack Kirby, and he's also a demon who does good, so he's a superhero. And Etrigan has the interesting quirk of he speaks in rhymes, and so the writers for Etrigan always have to put all of his dialogue in rhyming form.
Yeah, well, that won't make you popular with the writers on some days, but being a good demon, not going to make you popular with the other demons.
And no, actually, definitely not.
This provides us with a little bit of a transition to our first internet question. It's internet open forum. All of our questions have been submitted in writing via one mode or another on the internet. And Eliza asks this: if demons can possess people, could Raphael have possessed a willing host, such that when he introduced himself as Azarias, son of the great Ananias, he wasn't actually lying? I heard an answer recently where you addressed this falsehood, and my husband came up with this potential alternate solution.
Okay, so this is kind of like the episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, The Reckoning, where you have one of the good prophets possessing Major Kira and one of the evil Pah race possessing Jake Sisko, and they have a battle. So here you would have Raphael taking human form in order to battle Asmodeus, which is what happens in the Book of Tobit. Okay, it's a very creative solution, and I commend your husband for that. In principle, so to answer the first part of the question, angels and demons are essentially the same thing. It's just one is good and the other is bad. So they have the same fundamental abilities. And if demons can possess someone, then angels could possess someone too. Now, even demons, and so of course an angel wouldn't without, you know, permission from the person, at least under ordinary circumstances. And even demons seem to need permission. At least, now this isn't something that's 100% for certain, but it seems that a lot of the time the way demons work is they kind of grind a person down until the person is willing to consent to let the demon take control. That may or may not be the case, but it is something that's reported in the literature concerning demonic oppression. So it looks like both of them might actually need permission in order to take control of someone. However, as interesting as this theory is, and I think it's a fascinating theory, and I'd love to learn, you know, more about, you know, I'd love to look into Christian history and see, you know, what reports there may have been of angelic possessions of this nature. I wouldn't be at all surprised to discover some reports, at least. Whether they'd be accurate reports or not is a separate question. In fact, I know it's either the Decameron or I think it's the Decameron. There is actually a story of this. Now, the Decameron is a work of fiction. It's a kind of book of tales, kind of like 1001 Arabian Nights or the Canterbury Tales. You have these people. It's plague time, so we can all sympathize with that. It's plague time, and these Italians have gone out into the countryside to get away from the plague, and they're spending 10 days in the country, and each day they tell stories to each other to pass the time. And that's what the Decameron is. It's the 10 days. Decameron is Latin for 10 days. The Decameron is the 10 days where they tell these stories. And this is by a famous Italian author named Boccaccio. And one of the stories, this is all fiction, of course, but one of the stories involves a priest who is up to no good, and he's attracted to a noble woman who is not the sharpest knife in the drawer. In the story, she's referred to rather mockingly with terms like Lady Dimwit and so forth. But this priest is interested in her romantically. And so he goes to her and he tells her that the Archangel Michael has appeared to him. And Michael, being an angel, has no body and wants to know what human love is like. And so he has consented to allow the Archangel Michael to possess him for purposes of learning what human love is like. And Lady Dimwit, and Michael wants to experience human love with Lady Dimwit. And Lady Dimwit is just so flattered that the Archangel Michael would want to experience human love with her and willingly consents. And since this is a ribald comedy, things don't end up so well for this priest. He gets his comeuppance. At least in fiction, there have been reports of angelic possessions. And I wouldn't be at all surprised in the last 2,000 years to have, other reports. In fact, I remember years ago, back in the 1990s, shortly after I first started working at Catholic Answers, I got a phone call from the Archangel Michael. He called me up. He was interested in getting a free subscription to Catholic Answers magazine. I thought he was joking, but he assured me, no. I mean, he kept saying, no, I am the Archangel Michael. So he was very serious about being the Archangel Michael. He gave me his address at the United Domains of Heaven Earth Embassy, and we gave him a subscription to what is now Catholic Answers magazine, figuring it couldn't hurt him to have it. So given experiences like that, I'm sure there are people who have reported being possessed by angels, and I'd love to learn more about that. However, that doesn't seem to be what's going on in Tobit, because at the end of Tobit, Raphael reveals himself and he explains who he really is, why he's here. And then in Tobit 12:19, so chapter 12, verse 19, he says this: "All these days," meaning the time he's been with Tobias, "all these days I merely appeared to you and did not eat or drink, but you were seeing a vision." And so this is an explanation of how he managed to pass as human, because he did eat and drink with Tobias and Tobit and other people in the story. And he says that really that was just a vision. I didn't really do that. And that would tell us a couple things. The first thing it would tell us is that Tobit, or Raphael, was not possessing a human being. Because if he was possessing a human being, then it wouldn't be a vision when that human eats and drinks. So since Raphael says it was just a vision, that would tell us that he doesn't really have a physical form and thus was not possessing a human being, as fascinating as that idea would be. Secondly, it shows us that by this point in Israelite history, they'd gotten the conceptual furniture needed to conceive of angels as pure spirits that don't actually have bodies. And that's something that we alluded to earlier in the show, that process of development from more anthropomorphized conceptions of God and angels to less anthropomorphized conceptions due to doctrinal, due to progressive revelation.
I love the speculation, however, Elisa, and thank you very, very much for the question. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Bishop Chad Zielinski from the Diocese of Fairbanks of Northern Alaska, and you are listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
You make an honest examination of conscience. You identify what your faults are. You make a firm purpose of amendment. You determine not to do them again. That doesn't mean you'll necessarily be successful, but you make that resolution. I've been eating too much pecan pie. I'm going to stop. Without that, I mean, you're really not contrite.
Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I wonder if the Archangel Michael is still getting his subscription, or maybe has become a donor in intervening. Did you address it, Archangel Michael, when you sent it? Do you remember, Jimmy?
I remember the address. I don't remember the specific name that we used.
Yeah. All right. It's Internet Open Forum. All the questions today coming from the internet, lots of great ones, still to come. Martin asks this: what blessings can a lay person give? What effect does it have? How does it differ from blessings given by priests, bishops, and deacons?
Okay, so there are actually a bunch of different blessings that lay people can give, and there's no easy way to summarize them. The way to find out what they are is to get a copy of a work known as the Book of Blessings, which is a book, as you would expect, that the Church publishes that contains different blessings that have been authorized for use. And in the preface to each individual blessing, it has an introduction that says who can give this blessing. And sometimes it is lay people. They tend to not be blessings of for entering consecrated states of life. Like you're not going to have a lay person giving a blessing to someone who's becoming a nun. You know, those type of blessings are given by members, you know, people who are ordained. Similarly, you're not going to have a lay person blessing a church. You know, the priest is going to be the one, or bishop is going to be the one to do a church blessing. You know, when you're consecrating a church for use as a sacred place, that's going to be done by a bishop or maybe a priest, but not a lay person. On the other hand, blessings given to other lay people can frequently be done by lay people. And a classic example of that is the St. Blaise Day throat blessing, you know, where people go up and they get their throat blessed. Well, that's that one can be done by lay people. And there are lots of others, but they tend to be ones where one lay person is blessing another lay person or something that is not intimately connected with, you know, with worship, like a church building. In terms of what effect do they have? Well, they have, in general, the same type of effect that any other blessing has. What you do when you're blessing someone is you speak well of them. You wish some good on them or on an object, and you're essentially asking God to give his grace to maybe in a particular form, like health or function. Like if you're blessing an object, may this tool that we're blessing help us with our work or whatever it may be. But you're essentially asking God to do good for or through something. And it's then up to God what he does. This is the inverse of a curse. In the case of a curse, you speak ill of someone. You wish harm on them. You wish evil on them. And you're hoping that some supernatural being like God, if you're cursing someone in God's name, will then cause that harm to come about. So the flip side of that is a blessing. You speak well of someone or something and hope that God will do good for or through that blessed entity. In terms of would it have a different level of effect than if the same blessing were given by a priest or deacon, there is no answer to this. It's a matter of theological speculation, not a matter of church teaching. On the one hand, you might say, well, priests and deacons are specially consecrated to God's service, and so maybe a blessing given by a priest or deacon is one that God would listen to a little more because they're specially consecrated to him. But on the other hand, that could be more than compensated for if you got a really holy layman. You know, if you've got a really pious layman or laywoman, and you've got a kind of iffy priest or deacon, the layperson's blessing might have more effect than the priest's. So there's really no answer to that. Also, because blessings are given in the name of the church, they represent an intervention on the part of the church. And so the church's authority is also in play, not simply, or the church's relationship to God is also in play. It's not simply a matter of the qualities of the individual giving the blessing. The church, through that person, is also asking God for this blessing. And so the church's intervention with God is also in play here.
Thank you very much, Martin, for that question. We continue with Internet Open Forum. Lots of great questions from the Internet. Dan wants to know this. If God is omniscient, why does he create souls he knows? Why does he create souls he knows are going to he is going to throw into hell at the end of their life?
Okay, so this question comes up pretty frequently, and I've heard a lot of people take stabs at it, and I have not been impressed with a lot of the stabs I've heard. People tend to talk around the question and discuss issues like free will and stuff, and then end up saying it's a mystery. Or at least they will either talk around it and appeal to free will, or they'll say it's a mystery, or both. And so a couple of years ago, I decided I'm going to write on this subject. And so I wrote a post. It's at jimmyakin.com. It's called "Why Would God Create People He Knows Will Go to Hell?" And so I'll give a short answer now, but really for a longer discussion, you should Google "Why Would God Create People He Knows Will Go to Hell?" Jimmy Akin, and it will come up. And you can then read it online and get my more considered treatment. But basically, I go through several different options. One of them, and this isn't my personal solution, but one of them is maybe he doesn't. Maybe Cardinal Hans Urs von Balthasar was right, and God only creates people he knows are going to go to heaven. So even though we have free will and could damn ourselves, maybe no one actually does that. And we might, in Cardinal von Balthasar's words, dare hope that everyone goes to heaven. So that's one possibility. It's not mine, but I mention it for the sake of completeness. Another possibility is that people, even in hell, are better off than if they never existed. That being in hell isn't so bad that it deprives existence of all meaning. It may be painful, it may be frustrating because they're hurting themselves. That's what cutting yourself off from God does. But it may still be better to exist even in hell than to not exist. Then, and there are several other solutions as well, I'll tell you what my preferred one is. It's to reject the premise. The premise that this question is based on assumes that God knows before he creates someone what that person will do with their free will. So God without creating someone, knows the outcome of that person's free will decisions. This is a form of knowledge that many theologians have speculated that God has. It's called middle knowledge. It's the knowledge of what would have happened in other circumstances where free will is involved, but it's not something the church teaches God has. If you go back and look at Aquinas, for example, he does not hold that God has middle knowledge. He holds, and others of his period held, that God has two kinds of knowledge. He knows everything that's possible, and he knows everything that's actual. But what someone would have done by free will if they were created is not simply a possibility. You're saying what they would have done, not what they could have done. And it's also not actual because the person didn't get made. And so if God has only the two classic forms of knowledge, knowledge of what's possible and knowledge of what's actual, and does not have middle knowledge, then he wouldn't know prior to creating someone what they're going to do with their free will. He would have to, from his vantage point outside of time, create the person and then see what they do with their choices. And so he wouldn't be able to say, ooh, if I create Bob, Bob is going to damn himself, so I'm not going to create Bob. In order to answer the question, what will Bob do with his free will, God would have to create Bob and see what Bob does. And so he couldn't refrain from creating someone based on a knowledge of what they would do if created. And this is the version that I find attractive, because it seems to me that if you think about middle knowledge of what someone would do with their free will in a circumstance that never occurs is a problematic concept, because what is it that determines the outcome of their free will decision? It's not anything outside of the person. You know, it's not like we're machines and all the particles in our bodies interact in a way that determines our outcome. It's not that God has fated the person to do something, so God's not controlling the person. It's the person's own choice. And in a genuinely free will decision, if the person never makes that choice, then it seems to me that there is no answer. You know, because the choice has not been made. If it's the choice that makes the answer and the choice is never made, then there is no answer to the question. It's like, what's south of the South Pole? And so I would say that I find the concept of middle knowledge of free will situations problematic. And therefore, I find this an attractive solution to the dilemma.
Thanks, Dan, for that question. Maybe we'll see if we can get that link put in the show notes. So if anybody wants to check out the show notes there, they can get it. But why would God create people he knows would go to hell? Jimmy Akin, just put in that kind of thing and you'll come upon it on the internet. I'm going to go on to Kathleen's question now. Kathleen, Jimmy, I love your mysterious world.
Kathleen, thank you.
Can you explain what the apostolic pardon is? I think many people would be interested to learn about this since none of us are getting out of this world alive. Thank you and God bless.
Sure. So the apostolic pardon is an indulgence that is offered to people as part of the last rites. The last rites are ceremonies that people typically receive right before they die. The apostolic pardon is one of them. It's hoped to be a plenary indulgence that will spare the person purgatory, or at least a lot of purgatory. It's typically given in association with viaticum, which is the final reception of Holy Communion. It also may be given in connection with anointing of the sick. and it can be given in conjunction with confession. But those four things, confession, anointing of the sick, viaticum or last communion, and the apostolic pardon, are the four typical last rites. And what someone receives in an individual case will vary from person to person. You know, if they're unconscious, they can't go to confession, for example. But it's simply a final indulgence given in at the end of life in order to try to spare someone from purgatory or as much of purgatory as possible.
So someone who says so-and-so got the last rites, I don't know if they got the apostolic pardon. Actually, apostolic pardon is one of the rites.
Correct. And it's one that's almost always given because there's nothing to defeat it, really. As long as the person is still alive, you can give him the apostolic pardon. He doesn't have to do anything. So it's not like confession where he has to be conscious.
Kathleen, thank you for that very, very much, and for your kind words about Jimmy Akin's mysterious world. We will take a very quick break. Be right back with more of what the internet wants to know and Jimmy Akin's answers. Internet Open Forum continues right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Can you defend the Church's teaching on the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist? Do you desire a deeper relationship with our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament? Join us September 22nd through 25th for the annual Catholic Answers Conference in San Diego. This year's theme is the Eucharist. I am with you always. Featuring all the Catholic Answers speakers and special guest Bishop Thomas Papracki, use promo code EARLY to save $50 when you register at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles, to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Cy Kellett, your host. It's Labor Day all across America, and we thank you for taking this time with us. You know what? Sometimes on a holiday here in the U.S., it occurs to me that maybe you're listening for the first time because normally you're doing something else at this time, maybe going to work or at work. And so let me just tell you a little bit about us. Catholic Answers is an apostolate, a Catholic apostolate of lay people devoted to explaining and defending.
Now, you just used a technical word, apostolate. How would you say that in a way that would be understood by non-Catholics?
I think most people, like the word ministry would be the one that they would. Yeah. So a ministry of lay Catholics who explain and defend the Catholic faith. And you can find us at Catholic.com. You can find out all about us there and see what we do. And we're glad to have you as a listener. If this is not a convenient time for you to listen, check out maybe listening to the replay on EWTN or on any of our services, YouTube or Facebook or our own website, Catholic.com.
Or, or on a podcast app, because we have
a daily
podcast. Just go to any podcast directory of your choice and type in Catholic Answers Live.
This hour, it's an open forum. We do open forum usually a couple times a week, but this is a little bit different open forum. It's an internet open forum. All of our questions are in written form. And this one comes from Noah. And Noah asks about a book to start here. And I am, as soon as I say it, I'm going to interrupt myself to ask you about the book, Jimmy. Noah says, "The Enchiridion of Indulgences seems to grant a plenary indulgence at the moment of death." Hang on a second. Back up. Enchiridion of Indulgences sounds like a movie book that people would say that some kind of medieval Catholic book. What's the Enchiridion of Indulgences?
Yeah, it does sound kind of like a medieval Catholic magical tome or something that you could get a spell out of, but that's not what it is. The term Enchiridion is late Latin, and it comes from Greek roots. In Greek, hair is the word for hand. Okay. So, and en is a preposition that means in, means just like what it sounds like in English. So, in hair in Greek is going to mean in the hand. And idion is a suffix that means a little thing. So, by its roots, encheridion in Greek would mean a little thing that goes in your hand. But what it practically means is a handbook. Uh-huh. And so encheridion in Greek is a handbook, and in late Latin, encheridion is a handbook because they don't have the ch sound in Latin. So they convert it into a K and a K sound. And so the Enchiridion of Indulgences is a little handbook that contains different indulgences that you can obtain. And so that's what it is. It's the church's official book of indulgences. Sometimes you'll see English translations of it that are just called Handbook of Indulgences.
No.
But these days, they tend to leave it in Greek or late Latin, and so it becomes the Enchiridion of Indulgences.
It's just so much better than the Handbook of Indulgences, the Enchiridion. Yes. But so here's what
way
Noah.
Cooler.
It does. It's way cooler. Noah says, "The Enchiridion of Indulgences seems to grant a plenary indulgence at the moment of death to every Catholic who makes a regular practice of praying throughout their life. Can you confirm this, whether this is something automatically applied to every Catholic who regularly prays such that purgatory for praying Catholics is not an option?"
Okay, so this is essentially an indulgence that is meant to take the place of the apostolic pardon that we just talked about before the break. So if, like, a priest can't get to you to give you last rites or something, you can still obtain the equivalent indulgence at the moment of death, provided that you've been in the habit of, you know, praying sometimes during your life. And so if you look in the Enchiridion of Indulgences, it has the indulgences are all numbered, and number 28 is an indulgence for the moment of death. And it says this: "To the faithful in danger of death who cannot be assisted by a priest to bring them the sacraments and impart the apostolic blessing with its plenary indulgence," that's the apostolic pardon, "Holy Mother Church nevertheless grants a plenary indulgence to be acquired at the point of death, provided they are properly disposed and have been in the habit of reciting some prayers during their lifetime. The use of a crucifix or cross to gain this indulgence is praiseworthy." So it's praiseworthy to, like, be holding a cross as you're asking God for this indulgence, but you don't have to. "The condition, provided they have been in the habit of reciting some prayers during their lifetime, supplies." So this is the condition you have to do to get the indulgence. Provided they have been in the habit of reciting some prayers during their lifetime, supplies in such cases for the three usual conditions required for the gaining of a plenary indulgence." And I'll talk more about those in a minute. There are normally three conditions you have to fulfill to gain a plenary indulgence. "The plenary indulgence at the point of death can be acquired by the faithful even if they have already obtained another plenary indulgence on the same day." And then elsewhere in the general introductory document in the Handbook of Indulgences or the Enchiridion of Indulgences, it talks about the three conditions you normally need to do in order to obtain a plenary one. Norm number 7 says of that document says to acquire a plenary indulgence, it is necessary to perform the work to which the indulgence is attached, like saying a certain prayer or something, and to fulfill three conditions. So here are the three conditions that are dispensed with for the moment of death indulgence, provided you've prayed during your life: sacramental confession, Eucharistic communion, and prayer for the intentions of the Supreme Pontiff. So you don't have to do those on your day of death. You don't have to receive sacramental confession. You don't have to take Eucharistic communion, and you don't have to pray specifically for the intentions of the Pope, provided you've said some prayers during your life. You know, so it, you know, doesn't have to be a robust prayer life, but you know, something. However, there is one more requirement that is not one of the three that is dispensed, and it's the next and last thing mentioned in norm number 7 for obtaining a plenary indulgence. It is further required that all attachment to sin, even venial, be absent. So you have to free yourself of all attachment to sin, even venial sin, if you want the indulgence to be plenary, if you want it to remove all of the consequences of sin that remain to be dealt with. And so Noah had asked, as a result of this indulgence, is it the case that purgatory for praying Catholics is not an option? No. Because you can be in the habit of prayers in your life, and on your last day, you can still have some attachment to sin. And as long as you have some attachment to sin, it's not going to be plenary for you. It will be partial, and it will help you, and you should definitely pursue it, but it won't be plenary unless you're able on your dying day to remove all attachment to sin.
Wonderful, wonderful. Noah, thanks. And I guess we're kind of closing out a series of questions in this regard with Martin's question then. So Martin asks, does the penance given in the confessional in response to a good full confession equate to a plenary indulgence?
No. So the penance that you're given in confession is something that helps deal with the consequences of sin, but it does not remove them entirely. This has always been the understanding of the church, that even when you go to confession and you make a good confession and you do your penance, there may still be some consequences from your sins that you need to learn your lesson for. It's kind of like when, you know, you've got a kid and the kid's done something wrong and the kid says, I'm sorry, I wish I hadn't done that. You as a parent may realize, okay, that's good. I'm reconciled with my child now. They've said they're sorry, but they still need to learn their lesson. So I'm still going to ground them for a week, and that's essentially what purgatory. That's essentially what purgatory does. It's to help us purge ourselves of the disordered desires that we have that lead us to sin. It's a way of removing the brokenness that we have. And so even when you go to confession and even when you have done your penance, you may still have some brokenness that's going to need to be cleaned up. And so just doing your penance is not the equivalent of a plenary indulgence.
If you want to know about the plenary indulgences, Martin, just get the Enchiridion of Indulgences. I'm going to say that as many times as I can.
Get that in your hand.
Get that Enchiridion in your hand. Thanks for all those last three questions. Martin, thank you for that question. We have to take a break now. More Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN Heavenly Hints.
Next time you change your computer password, consider adding a sacred reference into the secret mix. It could be a chapter and verse of your favorite scripture, the name of your patron saint, the title of a prayer, the page number to a beloved hymn, or the initials of all four. The choices and combinations are endless. So is the joy.
A Heavenly Hint from EWTN.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Open forum this hour with Jimmy Akin, our guest, Jimmy, senior apologist at Catholic Answers. It's an internet open forum. I get to read the questions. Jimmy gets to answer them. And the next one comes from Anthony. Anthony asks, what is the canonical status of the Greek introduction to the Book of Sirach? Is it considered to be an inspired part of the book, or is it more like the Greek Ezra, 3 Maccabees, or Psalm 151, a work associated with the Bible and sometimes even printed in the Bible, but not considered to be scripture?
Okay, so we should talk about what the introduction is. So the Book of Sirach is a book that it was written. It's actually kind of, it's a little bit misnamed because it would imply that a guy named Sirach wrote it. And yeah, no, it's actually written by Sirach's grandson. Sirach's grandson was a guy named Jesus, or Yeshua. And he was the son of another guy, and then that guy was the son of Sirach. So it's really the book of the wisdom of Jesus, the grandson of Sirach, but it just gets called the Book of Sirach. Well, to add to the generations that we have going on here, Sirach's own grandson translated it from Hebrew into Greek. And for a long time, all we had was the Greek version. But more in recent years, I believe in the 19th century, we found the original, or at least a good chunk of it, in the original language. And of course, it didn't have the Greek introduction that was written by Sirach's grandson. And so it's an interesting question that you could kind of go either way on, because God doesn't have to inspire just one edition of a book. He can inspire more than one edition. And a case of that is the book of Jeremiah. Because Jeremiah, originally, he's giving his prophecies, he's having his scribe Baruch write them down, and he gives a copy of proto-Jeremiah, like a first edition of Jeremiah, to the king in Israel, and the king doesn't like what it says, so he cuts it up and burns it a piece at a time. And so after that, Jeremiah reconstructs the book. And so what we're reading in our Bibles is like Jeremiah Mark 2. So God can inspire more than one edition of the same book. And in fact, we have evidence for other instances in Scripture where that's happened. So it could be that God inspired Jesus, grandson of Sirach, to write the book, and then it could be that Jesus then inspired Jesus's grandson to translate it and write the introduction. So this could be an inspired second edition with added bonus preface. And there hasn't been a definitive ruling on that question. Now, the Council of Trent ruled that the books that were in the Vulgate, or at least a certain set of books that were in the Vulgate, with all their parts, are sacred and canonical. the question is, what does with all their parts mean? It obviously means the parts of Daniel and Esther that were denied by Protestants, because Daniel and Esther are both books that had more than one edition. And there's an earlier proto-canonical version of Daniel and Esther, and then there's an expanded deuterocanonical version of Daniel and Esther. And so it's obvious that the Council of Trent was trying to include those parts that were being disputed by Protestants. That's without question. But they weren't trying to say that you can't debate what the original text contained, or that every variant reading that's found in a book of scripture somewhere is also sacred and canonical. So you can do a kind of critical discernment of, well, okay, is this verse, if this wasn't in the original, maybe we shouldn't consider this verse sacred and canonical. That's perfectly fine. But then in between the two, there are certain fringe cases. In the New American Bible, which is the one published by the Catholic bishops of the United States, they have introductions. And what I've found is in their introductions, they tend to lean conservative. Now, the New American Bible has a reputation for being kind of liberal on some stuff, but on the question of is this passage canonical, they tend to be conservative and say yes, even though it might be questionable. Well, what do they say about the Greek introduction to Sirach? They say this: though not included in the Jewish Bible after the first century AD, nor therefore accepted by Protestants, the wisdom of Ben Sira, that's Sirach, has been recognized by the Catholic Church as inspired and canonical. The foreword, though not properly part of the book, is always included with it because of its antiquity and importance. So they're saying the book of Sirach itself, that was written by Jesus, grandson of Sirach, that's sacred and canonical, and the foreword by the grandson of Jesus, grandson of Sirach, is always published with it because of its antiquity and importance, but not because it itself is sacred and canonical. So the position taken by the introductors of the New American Bible, speaking on behalf of the Catholic bishops of the United States, would seem to be that the introduction to Sirach is not canonical, but is just associated literature, like Psalm 151, which is sometimes published in the Vulgate, even though it's not considered canonical. So they would put it in this category. And to my mind, that's remarkable because, as I say, they tend to want to say passages are canonical, even when there's a little bit of debate about that. So they tend to lean conservative on this, but they don't when it comes to the introduction to Sirach.
Anthony, thank you very, very much for that question. I hope that answer was helpful to you. We got internet open forum this hour and still some good questions to get to. So onward we go. Eric asks this: what is the difference between sinful usury of the biblical times and non-sinful usury of modern times?
Okay, so usury historically and in biblical times was understood to be any taking of interest on a loan. And in modern times, with the development of a modern economy, it's been realized that that there can be a role for the taking of interest. Now, you wouldn't call the taking of interest, all taking of interest, usury. So it's not like there's a non-sinful form of usury.
Yeah. Okay.
So the question would need to be rephrased a little, but in terms of what taking of interest is usurious and therefore sinful, and what taking of interest is non-usurious and non-sinful, that's something that we don't have a definitive answer to. The church has recognized that the taking of interest can be legitimate, but it hasn't clearly worked out the exact parameters. of that. This is a matter that the church allows moral theologians and economists to discuss. So it's something that you could, it's still under doctrinal development. We know it's not all taking of interest, but we don't have a good grasp of exactly what taking of interest would qualify as usurious. So it's still under doctrinal development, and it's presently a matter of theological opinion and debate. What we could say with some confidence is that an excessive taking of interest would be usurious, but that just kicks the can down the road, because how do you know what's excessive and what's not? And that's where the theological debate would lie. So that's a sketch of the situation. Originally, all taking of interest was understood to be wrong, and now only some forms, like of excessive taking of interest, would be considered wrong. But exactly what's excessive is a matter of debate.
Eric, thank you. On we go to Jonathan. Jonathan asks this: is somebody who is unable to access their preferred form of the Mass, that is, someone who would usually go to a Latin Mass and only a Novus Ordo Mass is acceptable, or vice versa as well, required to attend another form to meet their Sunday Holy Day obligation? And if so, what can someone say to somebody who is convinced that they are excused from their obligation if their preferred form of the Mass is not accessible on a given obligatory day?
Okay. So in answer to the first question, if your preferred form of Mass isn't available on a Sunday or Holy Day, you are not excused from your Sunday obligation. You've got to go to Mass. Your personal preferences do not enter into it. And in terms of what to say, I mean, I could prefer all kinds of things, but you can't always get what you want. But if you try, sometimes you get what you need.
That's a mix set.
And the Mass is what you need. So you might like a certain style of Mass. You might like a certain parish's form of Mass, you know, just the way the priest does it at that parish. But if he's out of town, you still got your Sunday obligation. So suck it up and go to Mass. And that's also what you can tell someone who thinks they are excused. However, you can go a little further than suck it up and go to Mass. You can also read them what the law says. This is found in the Code of Canon Law. And Canon 1247 says this. This is the canon that establishes Sunday obligations. It says this: on Sundays and other holy days of obligation, the faithful are obliged to participate in the Mass. Period. Okay? There's nothing in there about preferences. So it does not matter what your preferences are. The faithful are obliged to participate in the Mass on Sundays and other holy days of obligation. So that's what the law says. You're departing from the law if you add other conditions in there. It then goes on to talk also about, you know, abstaining from works that are going to hinder the worship of God and the rest proper to the Lord's Day and stuff like that. But as far as the Mass obligation goes, on Sundays and other holy days of obligation, the faithful are obliged to participate in the Mass, period. Now, having said that, You can go to whatever kind of Mass you prefer if it's available. The very next canon, Canon 1248, Section 1, guarantees that. It says, a person who assists at a Mass celebrated anywhere in a Catholic rite, either on the feast day itself or in the evening of the preceding day, satisfies the obligation of participating in the Mass. So you got to go to Mass on Sundays and holy days of obligation, but you can do that at a Mass celebrated anywhere in a Catholic rite. So it doesn't have to be the rite that you belong to. Like if you're a Latin rite Catholic like I am, you could go to a Chaldean rite Catholic Mass on a Sunday or holy obligation. Doesn't matter what they're doing. It might be one feast day with one set of readings on the Latin calendar, and it And it might be another day with a completely different set of readings on their calendar. But as long as I go to that Mass, it's in a Catholic rite, I satisfy my obligation. So you got to go. But beyond that, you got a lot of freedom about which form of Mass you go to.
Suck it up and go to Mass. Jonathan, thank you very much for the question. Jimmy, thank you very much for these 2 hours on Labor Day. Appreciate it.
No problem. We should put Suck It Up and Go to Mass on a coffee mug or something, or a t-shirt.
Oh, yeah, we need a Suck It Up and Go to Mass t-shirt. So this week, Jimmy Akins with Serious World, it's about Spring Heel Jack.
Yeah.
Who I just learned about today, and now I got to find out about this blue flame breathing devil, or maybe not a devil, maybe superhero. I'll find out on Jimmy Akins Mysterious World. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.